So welcome everybody to All About Symbian Insight number 46. It's Steve Litchfield here in Reading.
Rafe Blanford in Sussex.
And Ewan Spence here coming to you from Transylvania on Halloween. Yeah, we're going out on Monday, aren't we, guys?
Yep.
Hey, it's Ewan in Edinburgh. Hello, everybody.
Nice one. Anyway, news. Let's start with some news. For the big news of the week. Big news of the week is that my band has its first EP out. No, that's
Yay!
That's not the real best news, right? Rafe, there's something exciting for DataViz. There's a new product out from them. Why should people choose DataViz's product rather than Mail for Exchange?
Right, so DataViz have released RoadSync version 4 this week. And in common with Mail for Exchange, which is the Nokia solution, this enables you to sync with a Microsoft Exchange 2003 or 2007 server, and that's for push email, your contacts, your calendar, your notes and your tasks. Now, clearly, that having a free solution from Nokia is great, and RoadSync is costs $50 for a one-off license or $30 if you're an existing user as an upgrade. So is it really worth it? Now, there are quite a number of differences, so my answer to that question would be yes. The really big one for me is HTML email, which you don't get anywhere else on S60, but with RoadSync version 4, you get full support for HTML email within the S60 messaging application. Now, RoadSync have done this by calling on the built-in web browser, uses obviously the WebKit engine, and developers can use an API call to get that working in their applications. I have to say, it's very impressive what DataViz has done here. It works brilliantly well, has the same zooming controls as the browser, so you press the star and the hash key, zoom in and out, which means even on a small screen, you can read almost any HTML email. And given that an awful lot of email still comes by with HTML formatted, I think it's an invaluable tool. You know, lots of email has fairly simple formatting, and you know, you can get by with the standard S60 messaging client. But it does add a certain something to have the, you know, the bolds and all the hyperlinks ready to go. And of course, all of those open up as they should. There's a few other bonuses as well. You also get a sync of contact photos. Now, it seems a slightly small thing, but you know, when you get that appearing in Outlook 2007 and on your phone and on incoming calls, it's great. And obviously, with the mobile device, it's got the camera built in, so you're more likely to add contact photos there. So it's a nice to have. RoadSync have also added task synchronization in this particular version. That gets them up to equal with Mail for Exchange. But there's also a lot of usability things in RoadSync that just, in my opinion, make it a better product than Mail for Exchange, particularly in reference to some of the compatibility with Exchange 2007 features. And here I'm thinking about the ability to flag emails for later follow-up or to do a proper search on server, either for your contacts or for your email. You know, it's very handy if you've got all your email on your phone. That's fine. You've got the last maybe 5 days. But if you do a search on server, however much email you've got stored on your server, which may go back anything up to a couple of years, you can search through it. And I know when I'm on the road, sometimes I need to get at a piece of information that I may have got by email several weeks ago. So that's an invaluable bit of functionality, and they've implemented it very well in the RoadSync product. So thumbs up from me all round, really.
Yeah, or you could just use Gmail. No, I didn't say that. No, there's, as ever, it's good to have choice, and certainly for corporates, that's a very good option. Yeah. DataViz is RoadSync. It's also worth mentioning that ProfiMail, that the Lonely Cat Games email client that's been around for donkey's years, that also has a rich text HTML viewing of emails as well. So there are, again, it's not quite the unique product in that regard, but certainly well worth a look, and I'm sure Rafe will be giving us a full review of RoadSync.
Indeed.
In the near future.
Indeed, but it is worth pointing out that this is actually full HTML support, and clearly it's only worth it if you've got an Exchange account or you're a business user, but this does go considerably beyond what ProfiMail and you can get via Gmail, although I think those are both absolutely fine for a consumer solution.
There's certainly a minefield of confusion in terms of the sheer number of email options. I think this is building up into a need for a major feature from All About Symbian, because there's just so many different ways you can get your email, and that's not including Nokia's beta of their own Nokia email service, which is due to go commercial very soon. Just moving on to other news, One. What's One, Ewan? What does it involve, and is it any good?
Well, a long time ago, in a film by Russell McKee, they said there can be only one, and that word is, of course, Highlander. And Nokia, this is their second game where they need to find one person who's very good at fighting. It's a carry-on from their original first-person title, one which came out on the original N-Gage platform and by all means was regarded as a successful bit of programming. Coming out of Spanish developers Digital Bridges, one is essentially a fighting game with a... It is a 2D fighting game in a 3D environment. Now, by that I mean you can move left and right and back and forward. And for those of you who've ever played Double Dragon in the arcades, kids, look it up on Wikipedia. Steve, just turn around behind you. You've probably got a poster of it. You basically fight other people on your handset. It's, you know, you can punch, you can kick, you can throw them around, you can dance around like a fairy, you can jump. It's all the sort of things that the Mary Whitehouse would hate that are in modern arcade fighting game. And I have to say, this is the second version for the new person. Rafe says it's Digital Legends. So who are Digital Bridges then? They're a games company out of Dundee, I think. They've done the Crystal Maze, actually, which I'll talk about in another episode. So where are we? Yes, one, automatic lock-in. No, wrong game. Right, well, it's really well put together. The fighting genre is one that has a lot of fans. There are a lot of people that just don't give these sort of games the time of day, partly because they look too complicated, partly because they look a bit like butter mashing. And one finds a nice balance. Unlike the previous version on the original N-Gage platform, there aren't the special moves that you do as opposed to punch. You might be able to do dragon punch with fireball and spikes coming out of your hand. Previously, you needed, on the first version, you needed to do about 11 or 12 button presses on your mobile keypad to set up that combination. Now it's only two or three, and you have a power meter as well, which means there's a lot more integration in the fact that it's a mobile platform, that you don't have a lot of keys. You've essentially only got up, down, left, right, and maybe two or three action buttons. Okay, the graphics... I was taking a pause there. But no, go on, Steve.
I have to say that the one that seems like one of these games where you don't actually make any progress unless you can memorize about 282 different sequences, but it does sound like it's simpler than the average fight 'em up.
Yeah, certainly the original one on N-Gage Classic had the problem of needing 282 key button presses. Here, it is a lot simpler. And when you play these for a little bit, you know, there is a skill involved. You do have to see watch what your opponent is doing, and that's where the graphics need to be very clear and precise. And I have to say, that is one of the things that the new version of one has done incredibly well. The debate will continue about whether the N-Gage platforms should have a 3D chip or not. As it stands, though, the platforms aren't using a 3D chip. What we're using here is hand-optimized, rasterized graphics. Now, that's very, very time-intensive to create, but it does create a wonderful look, and that's what you have. We're probably here at the limits of what 3D can do without having any sort of extra hardware in the machine to take away the mass processing of adding and shading all the relevant triangles. For example, hair bounces. I mean, it's not a lot, but hair, you know, there's some spare processor cycles. But you can see when arms are lifted up, our legs out of the way, parts of the bodies are open up to do your punches and kicks. The big problem with one is the keyboard. The original, actually, I've had the original N-Gage Classic version now, and much as it's a little bit more complicated, slower and smaller screen, it has one serious advantage, and that is it's got a proper control pad. Unlike the phone pad, the original N-Gage, and especially the N-Gage QD, had the rocker switch. It's much easier to do for a fighting game, much more solid button presses, and it feels like you can be quite violent with the controls. When you're playing this in like an N95 8GB, it can feel quite a fragile bit of kit in your hands, because you really need to be quite... You get quite violent in these games. The violence in the screen comes through in your adrenaline. You start punching these buttons quite hard, and they're not really up to the job. I actually think that the biggest limiting thing in one is the input that you have into the game, and it's a strong argument to have a gaming-optimized handset. Not necessarily another taco, but something where the control pad is designed like something on a Nintendo DS or on a Sony PSP, and I think that's where one lets down. As always, try the demo. There's no need for you not to. Nokia are very good at that. I went straight into buying the paid version, so I really should check what the demo does. But there's been a lot of good buzz about this one. It has taken its time to come out, but it's nice. It's nice.
Yeah, thank you for that. That's a very thorough review, and I think Ewan's plan there was to put such a thorough review in the podcast that we wouldn't make him write the text version for the site. But
no, I just read out the text version.
No such luck.
No, you've got to go and write it properly, Ewan. We want it by 4 o'clock, please. Thank you.
Steve getting very bossy. That's my job.
Oh, sorry, Rafe. Moving on, one other item of news before we move on to more Symbian smartphone show stuff. The N96, Nokia N96, is finally in the house at All About Symbian Towers. I have to say, just give you my brief first impressions, and maybe from you guys as well before we move on. Everyone's been saying how that the N96 is very disappointing, and I thought to myself, well, it's not much of an improvement over the N95 8GB, is it? But I've just started listing improvements, and it's quite a long list. I'll just very briefly run through them. It's got hardware decoders for video, H.264 video and digital audio. That's all in hardware to save battery. It's got the 16GB of flash memory plus the microSD card slot. It's full USB 2 transfer speeds. It's slimmer. It's got dual LED flash, it's got the kickstand, it's got DVB-H digital TV receiver, it's got better position stereo speakers, it's got dedicated gaming controls on the top slide, dedicated music and media control keys on the front of the phone, it's got a lock and lock key, and loads of software improvements, including the relevant changes to RealPlayer and the internet subsystem so that you can run the BBC iPlayer client. And it's bundled with, you know, the usual 3-month navigation. It's bundled with a free N-Gage game, Tetris, as well. That's quite a long list of improvements, actually. So I think Nokia are being unfairly criticised on this device, and I found it actually, people have been saying it's slow and glitchy. I've come across very few glitches and very few points at which it's slow. It's all going to be written up over the next day or two, and you should see the text review on allaboutsymbian.com probably within a day or two of listening to this podcast. So do watch for that. I'll be doing it in 2 or 3 parts and really hammering the multimedia capabilities of the N96. Rafe, do you want to just go with a 30-second your own impressions?
Yes, I mean, I've seen the sort of same criticisms of the N96. And what I would say about this is that for people looking to upgrade from the N95 8GB, it probably isn't worthwhile because, you know, they can, by adding in software and doing firmware updates, get many of the features that they would get from the N96. When you're coming up from something like the N95, I do think it's a different question. And I'd also point out that I think the design of the N96 is just more appealing to the mass market than the sort of slightly geeky, blocky N95 family. So, you know, I think actually this is an N-series high-end device that may appeal outside the traditional sort of N95 geek user. And in this sense, I think it's probably received some unfair press amongst bloggers and other mobile geeks, because I think it shows a lot of promise. And more to the point, when you actually think about what this device can do, it's a pretty staggering achievement. And to my mind, as Steve has said, there's quite a few improvements, but it's also a much more polished out-of-the-box experience. And while for a lot of people, you go, well, that's irrelevant because I can add the stuff, many people never add extra software or add very little or don't add many services. So I think having all that stuff in the box along with leaflets explaining the various services, is a really important difference. So, yes, there's more choice at the high end. You've got something like the N85, which we didn't really have equivalent to before. But to my mind, there's, we've now have the N79, the N85, the N96, all at different price points and all have relatively similar functionality, but each has their own thing going for them. So I don't think it's necessarily as bad as it's been painted in some areas.
I think it's that's completely fair to say. And the thing is, it's not a geek phone. And this, I think, is why the criticism that it's attracting, let's be honest, is criticism from people who are already deeply immersed in Symbian OS and S60, to the point of they know that it's S60, not Siri 60. And they're expecting Nokia to have a linear range of phone, which says this one is better than the last one, that's better than the last one, that's better than the last one. The N96 is a little bit better than the N95, but by majority, it's a lot better than the average handset that the man or woman in the street will see. This is not a handset that is better than a geek's handset. This is a handset for the market. It's in a different, almost marketing timeline strand that we have here. And the criticisms that we see, I have to say, are criticisms from people that
are using a lot of always on internet applications that are using these phones very, very heavily. And yes, they are designed for that, but they're edge cases. There are people who are right at the edge of the envelope. 95% of people will get through an entire day of battery life on this. 96% of people will use the iPlayer for a little bit of time, and this phone will be sufficient. The N95 8GB needs recycled in the stores. It just doesn't need recycled in the heads of the geeks. The geeks expect it to be recycled, therefore they go, it must be the N96. But in fact, it isn't. So I think it's a case of crossed wires here and people not looking outside of their own little space on the internet.
Yeah, I think you make an important point about the battery there, Ewan. Now, this has been, I think, perhaps the most criticised area of the N96, and it is worth pointing out that it does very much depend on what you're doing. If you're doing internet-heavy tasks like Twittering all day, I think the battery life may not measure up to something like the N95 8GB. As you may know, for those listening, that the battery capacity is actually smaller, but for certain tasks, the battery life is going to last much better. So, for example, if you're decoding video or listening to audio, you'll get much better battery life out of the N96 than you will the N95 family. Now, clearly, the expectations on the battery life are going to depend on what you use it for, and I do think the majority of users are going to be looking at music and video as their primary use case. There's also the processor, which, as Steve has mentioned, has got hardware decoding for video in it, but it also has sort of step-down features, which basically mean it's much more power-friendly than the OMAP family of processors that you get in the N95 family. So this means it's, you know, although the capacity I think is something like 50 to 75 milliamp hours less than in the N95 and even more so than the N95 8GB, the typical user probably won't notice that. Indeed, will in some cases find that the battery life will be better in the N96 than the N95 8GB. So, Steve, I know you've been using it for a few days. What have you found the battery life like?
I find it excellent. I charged it yesterday morning, and I've been playing with it and demoing it and running videos ever since, and I'm still on full bars. That's after 24 hours. Obviously, I haven't been perhaps using it on the internet as much as someone who's actually traveling a lot like a road warrior, but I've been impressed so far. As you say, the laws of physics dictate that if you've got the screen brightness on max and you've got the Wi-Fi always connected around the office, around the home, it is going to drain the battery faster than on the N95 8GB, where you've got the extra 200 or 300 milliamp hours of power to fund that through the day. This will run out sooner. But yeah, for the typical use case for the N96, what Nokia have designed it for, video and audio, I think it's going to be better than perhaps the any other Nokia device. Just to summarise my entire N96 upcoming review in two words, which I could just about do, or two one-word answers: is it as bad as some of the critics say it is? Definitely no. Is it as good as Nokia's mammoth marketing push would have you believe? No. It's as ever, the truth lies somewhere in between. But I have to say I'm siding with Nokia on this one rather than the geek critics so far. And more on the N96 over the next week or two, I'm sure. We've got a review unit in from Nokia PR. We've also got our own N96 arriving. And I think we're going to be pushing this device to its limits over the next couple of months, hopefully alongside things like the N95 and N79. Can we move on to a reader question that's come in, Rafe? That
absolutely. Ask away.
Okay, here we are. This is from Morpheus2702. We've had loads of great feedback about the podcast, but this is actually a genuine question. He's referring back to our chatting about UIQ, Sony Ericsson, Samsung, and all the different platforms and interface chopping and changing over the next last year and the next year. And his question is here: with the Omnia and Xperia X1 both running Windows Mobile, is it blinkered to say that both Samsung and Sony Ericsson are now fully backing S60 and the Symbian Foundation, or simply spreading their bets? In the podcast, it's mentioned that Motorola have been guilty of playing the platform game, hop, skipping and jumping. And you'll see more on that on the news page a couple of days ago, of course. Haven't Samsung historically done exactly the same thing, including some Palm-based oddities? Rafe, are Samsung spreading their bets as well?
Yeah, I think it's a perfectly fair comment to make. What I would say with regard to Samsung is they have gone on the record and said that 50% of their smartphones will be Symbian-based this year, and there's an expectation that that will increase in the future. If you also look at some of their investments and things like their developer program, S60 has happened first, and that's ahead of either Windows Mobile or Android. So, and I think we should probably differentiate that Samsung intends to use S60 certainly compared to Windows Mobile across a greater range and portfolio of devices. Now, clearly Samsung has followed a multi-strategy, so to say that they're only supporting Symbian is quite right to say inaccurate, but I do feel they are giving it very significant support. You know, Windows Mobile is still important, especially in the US market for Samsung, and clearly elsewhere in Europe, but I think its support of S60 is important both in Asia and in Europe, and we'll see more shipments of S60 Samsung smartphones than any other platform. With regard to Sony Ericsson, which I think also came up there, yes, they of course have the Xperia X1 Windows Mobile powered handset, and I think we could probably fairly anticipate that the next few Xperia handsets are also going to be Windows Mobile powered. Going further into the future of the Xperia line, I think there's every possibility that we'll see a Symbian Foundation powered Xperia handset. But the point I was really making in last week's podcast was they're actually going to use S60 in a similar way to Nokia, in that they're going to use it in some of their mid-range phones, which have typically used their proprietary OS, their feature phone OS. So we'll see sort of Samsung S60 phones from the mid-tier to the, sorry, Sony Ericsson S60 phones. So there'll be Symbian Foundation, of course, by that point. So quite how they'll be named, I'm not sure. But I'm thinking things here like, you know, the C905, which is their top-of-the-range camera phone, that may well run a Symbian Foundation software in the future, right down to some of the, you know, the things like the K850. So that's what I was trying to get across there. But I think it is a good point to realise that with the exception of Nokia, pretty much every manufacturer has a multi-platform strategy. I think it's quite possible we'll see that consolidate, and certainly having Symbian Foundation going open source is probably going to encourage some of these companies to focus more on Symbian. Motorola is a completely separate issue, so perhaps we should address that in the next point on the podcast, Steve.
Yeah, just to make a point in comparison between Sony Ericsson and Motorola, and going back to the question, I think there's a big difference between spreading your bets over different platforms and chopping and changing them on a yearly basis, which is what Motorola can arguably be said to have done. Certainly Samsung, their dalliances, for example, into Palm OS, you may just say, well, they didn't actually switch to Palm and then switch back. It was an experiment, and they actually persevered with the experiment for a good long time, and the device, those devices garnered some fans. So I think Samsung and Sony Ericsson certainly seem to be so far better at stickability. You, any comments on all this?
Yeah, I think it's a different way of corporate attitudes. Motorola did it rather like the hokey cokey. They were in, they were out, and then they kind of shook it all about. And Samsung have kind of started off very slowly, you know, did a couple of check bets. And then, as we've seen over the last month or two with their developer program, with their increased range of handsets, with their larger visibility, they've actually went all in, to use the poker term. So, yes, both companies have done a bit with everything else, but I think it's how they've done it that matters here, the implementation. Samsung have tested, went, that's good, we'll try a bit more, right, bang, full power, maximum burn, that's the one we're going for. Motorola have been rather like that girl on prom night who just will or won't or will or does dance and doesn't, then disappears around the corner and giggles with her friends and goes and finds the high school bully and then moves over to the football guy, you know. So I've more confidence in Samsung's approach now than I was with Motorola's approach, you know, 2-3 years ago. Rafe,
yeah,
like prom night to you?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I think the point you make there about having the multi-platform approach is key. And as I was saying before, it's about, you know, targeting the different markets. Nokia, arguably, if they'd released a Windows Mobile handset, might be doing better in the US market. Now, that would probably be a waste of time, simply because it doesn't make sense as a long-term investment. But Samsung, in particular, have been very successful in this sort of scattergun approach, if you will, in the one sense. But it's not they switch from one to the other and back to the other. They've actually released phones on all major platforms, and I think are going to continue to do so. I think we'll see some consolidation from them, and they'll probably be Windows Mobile, Android, and S60. But I would anticipate that continuing, you know, to serve different customer needs, i.e., different operators, in whichever way they choose.
Yeah, absolutely. We did promise some. We've been touching on issues raised at the smartphone show. Of course, one of the big things, the headline bits of news, if you like, was that UIQ was officially declared dead in its current form. Another question that is prominent on people's minds is, what role can UIQ technology now play in the Symbian Foundation? And I realise we haven't got a huge time left in the podcast, but Rafe, do you want to just field that briefly?
Yes, I will field this. I'll also just add in very briefly that Motorola made some announcements about OS strategy this week, which you'll have seen on the front page last week, effectively saying it was no longer going to use Symbian UIQ. Perhaps not a big surprise there. We might come back and talk about Motorola in a future week, but the implication of that is we're not going to see the UIQ handsets they had in development for 2009. So I think it's pretty fair to say at this point that UIQ's last hurrah isn't going to happen, and that it really is gone the way of the dodo, effectively. Now, it won't disappear altogether, as we've said before. Both in practical terms now, there's plenty of handsets and developers out there. But more importantly, it's going into the Symbian Foundation. And what role can it play there? Now, to my mind, I think where UIQ's expertise lies in how to implement Touch UI. And they certainly gave an interesting presentation at the smartphone show. I didn't get to attend it, but I had a look at the slide deck afterwards. And I suspect they could add a lot into a council that was looking at UI and deciding where to take Touch UI next. And having played a bit around with their 65th edition, I think that kind of expertise is sorely needed to evolve the platform into its next version. It's not that it's bad at the moment, but clearly there is room for more optimization around touch and discussion. And there's a lot of discussion about where touch is going next. So I really think they can contribute an awful lot there. And they certainly have, I think, probably the most expertise in the Symbian ecosystem. And the Symbian Foundation, with its sort of collegiate approach, is very well suited there.
I think the bigger question is going to be, what are Sony Ericsson going to be doing? Because UIQ is a wholly owned part of Sony Ericsson, and if SE are starting to pull away, you know, how much time, resources, engineering time, developers are they going to contribute to the foundation? That remains to be seen.
Well, I think they've already answered that question, to be fair. You know, they said they were going to be developing Symbian Foundation handsets and would see the first of those in the second half of 2009. So I think Sony Ericsson is fairly fully committed to the Symbian Foundation. Go on, Ewan.
It's also worth pointing out that although, you know, UIQ is there or not around, a lot of the engineers and people that were with UIQ originally have moved on to other areas in the Symbian ecosystem. It's very interesting when you go around the smartphone show to find out, to see where certain people from certain companies are working now. And whether, you know, where you could look 2 years ago, there was a core of people that certainly also all about Symbian you would recognize as the UIQ people. They're actually all out in different places of the ecosystem, and they will feed back into the foundation as well. So UIQ actually has a huge legacy that will be supporting the foundation as well from other different places, from places like Navtech, from places like Samsung, from Nokia, from Symbian, from Datavis, from QuakeOffice. Lots of those smaller companies actually have quite a bit of their knowledge with a lot of UIQ root.
That's right, and but they still have a sort of big engineering base now. UIQ Technology, the company itself, is likely to switch over to being a service software company, you know, helping software developers and manufacturers integrate devices and that sort of thing. But I also think it has plenty to teach us in terms of some of the elegance of the UI framework. The way UIQ did this was, having views, and developers could sort of effectively write their own UI widgets. And this was, I think, a very elegant approach, which we haven't really seen in S60, where the UI framework, it might be regarded by some as a bit messy. So I think it can contribute there. It's just a question of how much will the end consumer see. I suspect you won't see all that much of UIQ directly in the Symbian Foundation, especially at first. It's obviously going to be heavily S60 based. Especially in its first release, it'll effectively be a rebranded version of Symbian, S60 on Symbian. As we move to the first proper full Symbian Foundation release, I expect many of the expertise and the way of doing things and some of the thought about UI direction will come in from the others, from MoAP and UIQ, but you won't necessarily see recognisable UI widgets.
Yeah, as ever, I bow before the knowledge and analytical superiority of you guys. I think if anyone out there wants to hire Rafe or Ewan on a consultancy basis, I'm sure the hourly rate of £500 an hour won't be too much to bear. So do get in touch. That's all that we've got time for this insight. So it's a goodbye from me, Steve Litchfield.
And goodbye from me, Rafe Blanford.
And goodbye from me, Ewan Spence. And thinking with the way the UK economy is going, £500 quid's not that much anymore, is it?